Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for home theater geeks is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Home Theater Geeks with Scott Wilkinson, recorded November 2nd, 2011, episode 89. Stream on. This episode of Home Theater Geeks is brought to you by Ford, featuring available sync with My Ford Touch. Sync with My Ford Touch gets you to your destination with integrated turn-by-turn directions and directional arrows displayed on screen. Check it out in the new 2012 Ford Focus and at Ford.com/technology. And by Netflix. Watch thousands of TV episodes and movies on your PC, Mac, iPad, iPhone, or TV instantly. All stream directly to you, saving you time, money, and hassle. For your free 30-day trial, go to netflix.com/twit. Hey there, Scott Wilkinson here, online editor of hometheater.com. This week's guest geek is Michael Livornia, the editor of the newest addition to the web family that Home Theater is part of. It's called audiostream.com, and it's all about computer audio. Hey, Michael, welcome to the show.
Hey, Scott, how are you?
I'm great, thanks. Thanks so much for being on. Those who are tuned into the live video stream at live.twit.tv or logged into the chat room at irc.twit.tv can post questions for Michael, and I'll pass along as many as I can. So, Michael, I wanted to say, first of all, congratulations on the new site. It looks really great.
Thank you. It's a very nice opportunity, I think.
Yeah. Well, it's a great subject that people were really, really interested in, so I'm really glad to be able to talk about it on today's show. How long have you been posting? How long's the site been up?
This site went live just before Rocky Mountain, so early mid-October.
And Rocky Mountain, for those who don't know, is the Rocky Mountain Audio Fest, one of the biggest audiophile festivals that there is in the country during the year. And I know you were there covering it with many, many blog posts.
Yes, many, many. And I still came up short in coverage. I believe it's the largest consumer audio show in the country these days, with CES being the largest non-consumer audio show.
Right, sure, of course. And CES is not only audiophile, but also, you know, home theater, what I cover, plus a bunch of other stuff.
Gadgets.
So anyway, so certainly there's a lot of stuff that you covered at Rocky Mountain. But I wanted to start, your latest post was actually very interesting. It was a discussion and a description and some photos of your own listening room where you do your testing. Tell us about that, the equipment that's in there, the room treatment such as it is. Tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. Well, the room used to be a spare bedroom, and my family was kind enough to allow me to convert it. So I essentially just ripped up the carpet to expose the plywood subfloor, which is actually very good sounding. And because the room is so empty, devoid of furniture, I did use some homemade room treatments, wall hangings, which you can see over my other shoulder. I'm not used to this reverse.
Yeah, right.
And then there are echo felt panels in the area where I have my desk. In terms of the equipment I'm using to listen, what stays consistent are my speakers, which are Dvorak Fidelity the 9s. I use an integrated amplifier currently, the Leben CS300X. Art Dudley just reviewed the CS300 in Stereophile, I think last month. It's a tube-based integrated amplifier. I have a MacBook Pro, which is kind of the main computer I use as a music server. I have an iMac, which I am speaking to you through. I have an iPad. I have two PCs, one which I use mainly as a music server. And I do have a turntable in this system as well, the Riga P3.
Which brings up one question I was going to ask, which is PC or Mac for music? Is there a preference? Is one clearly better than the other?
No. The answer to that question
the shorter answer is no.
No. And that's almost, you know, really the answer to that question is nearly like asking someone's religion. It's a loaded question.
Yeah, it's true.
It's not even an exaggeration. But, you know, I mean, I think it's easy to say, and it's not arguable, that the Macintosh platform is much more user-friendly. But, you know, some people appreciate and would not want to do without the PC's ability for customization and control, let's say, access to functions that, let's say, on the Mac platform, you are locked out of more so. Mm-hmm. So I think the geekier, if we can stick with that term, since you called me a geek, and I freely admit that I am one.
We're all geeks on this bus, that's for sure.
The geekier and tweakier people tend, I think, would say to go toward the PC. Mm. You know, whereas the casual user and someone who's more interested in a plug-and-play solution, the Macintosh can be more appealing.
So
in terms of overall quality.
I was going to ask, the difference then seems to be more in terms of user interface and less in terms of the quality of the output.
Yes, I would not say that one will give you better results than another. It's how you want to get there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Getting back to your room, I noticed in one of the pictures you have your equipment and your listening chair and everything on a diagonal in the room.
Yes.
Which I found very interesting. How did that come about?
Well, what happened was I am friends with John DeVore, who makes the speakers that I own. So I invited him over, as well as Stephen Mahias, for a listening session to help me set up the room. And it was John's idea to try the diagonal because we were having some issues with the more traditional setup. And quite literally, as soon as he moved those speakers into the diagonal position, everything really clicked and fell into place. And you could really even hear, I think Stephen would back this up, it was a dB boost in volume as well, just by from placement alone. Nothing else had changed. So wow. It really speaker setup is probably the most important tweak that I think many people ignore.
Yes.
And once, you know, you get them basically situated, your speakers, then it does become a matter of inches that can make tremendous difference.
Really? So, moving the speakers around in a matter of mere inches one way or the other in the room will make a big difference, huh?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, yeah. Especially if your room is untreated, especially if your room is a problematic size, whether that means too small, too large, or not exactly a friendly geometry. So, you know, I believe I commented to someone on the site today that it's a two-person job at least, and then it's fun. If you're doing it by yourself, it's tedious and potentially problematic.
Right. Now, are you in your listening room right now as we speak?
I am. I did have to rearrange things just a tad to get the hardwired connection to the iMac. I typically use a wireless connection here. So I'm sort of, I'm not sure if you could really tell, I'm halfway into the listening room. Not really half, but farther out than I would typically be when I'm working.
Right. Because it sounds pretty echoey, but I suspect your voice does, but I suspect that's because you're relatively far from the mic that's in the computer. What we're hearing now is probably not an indication of how your room actually sounds when you're listening to music.
Not unless I'm singing with my echo set high, yes.
Yeah, right.
There's an entryway that's part of the room, which is where my desk sits. And I'm more in that area than I am in the listening room. So, gotcha. Yeah, there is some echo in here. When I try to eliminate more of the echo in the non-listening part of the room, it made a negative impact on the sound in the listening room. So I deal with echo, but I don't speak to myself out loud too much.
Understood. Let's see. I already got some questions in the chat room here. Beatmaster asks, how far do you see media players taking PCs away from the home cinema turf? I'm not sure if they're mutually exclusive. What do you think?
How far do I see media servers taking? You know, I don't, I'm not so sure I even understand the question completely. Well, has iTunes impacted the market?
Well, I guess media players, meaning dedicated media players, possibly. Beatmaster, if you're...
You can, so he's not speaking about software, he's speaking about hardware.
I think so, but if you can clarify that in the chat room, that would be great. But you do write about dedicated media servers, media players on your site, right? As opposed to general purpose computers used for the same purpose.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, I just I associate the term media player with software. You know, something like Amara or Channel D's Pure Music. But I'm actually in the process of reviewing the NAD C446. I believe they call it a media tuner. And that is actually one of the issues that I think we're still kind of wrestling with in computer audio is what to call what device. In other words, if you compare two music servers from different manufacturers, they can really be completely different beasts. So, the terminology is still working itself out.
Right. Right.
You know, it's almost like what would you expect to get from a media server? Would you expect it to have a drive to be able to rip your music? I mean, I sort of would, but not every media server has one.
Right, so. Exactly. Some of them simply pull the music off of your computer or off of a network attached storage or something like that.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
While others do, in fact, have hard drives and you can store stuff locally.
Yes, they do. And actually, yes. Yeah, very much so. Ethernet, that point, Ethernet connection is probably one of the more interesting developments, I would say, in computer audio. And you'll see it today to touch on another controversial subject.
Ooh, please do.
Music Direct is now selling the Audio Quest Ethernet cable line. So, you know, the idea...
Yes, Audio Quest being the company that makes relatively high-end, what we might call exotic audio and video cables with special silver construction and this and that. And they're, I guess what they must be claiming is that Ethernet cables make a difference to sound quality as well, right?
Yeah, absolutely. That is the claim. They make USB cables. They make HDMI cables. Mm-hmm. And again, there's a lot of controversy over the effectiveness of or even just the basic premise that a cable can make a difference. And many people who are most skeptical don't rely on listening as a means to determine whether or not they do in fact make a difference.
They rely on what, measurements, electrical measurements, that sort of thing?
Blind testing, although I've yet to see a reference to a blind test that's been documented. I mean, I see a lot of talk about it, but anyway. Yeah, it's an interesting subject, but Ethernet is definitely, I believe John Atkinson in the Stereophile forums referred to some measurements with Ethernet providing very good measured performance in terms of delivery, data delivery, absence of jittery.
That sort of thing, right?
Yeah.
Now, have you done any subjective listening to Ethernet cables to see if one sounds better than another?
As a matter of fact, at the Rocky Mountain Audio Fest, I was in the AudioQuest room and I got to hear a a demo of not only a comparison as well between one of their new Ethernet cables. I believe it was the it's the green cable. I always find their names a little difficult to recall, but I think they have cinnamon, diamond, coffee. Yeah. It's a little so, but in any event, I heard one of their new Ethernet cables compared to a standard, let's call it a Ethernet printer cable.
Okay.
And what we repeated the same track and switched back and forth a few times. And
now, was that by means of an Ethernet switch or physically unplugging and plugging?
Yeah, physical disconnect and reconnect.
Okay.
It happened very quickly. I remained seated. We listened to the same track. Steve Silverman from AudioQuest would do the disconnect and reconnect. We went back and forth a few times, and there was a very clearly noticeable difference. I wrote about this on the in my show coverage in
detail.
There
was a clear audible difference.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it was a Nora Jones track that we were listening to from an album I was unfamiliar with of remixes of her music. And there was a bass line that was a bit complex and, let's say, not fluid. It was very choppy. And with the stock Ethernet cable, it was extremely difficult to follow. It almost sounded as if there was a skip or something. I mean, it was very stunted, stilted, and choppy. And with the AudioQuest Ethernet cable, it was easily discernible as what the bass player was actually doing. And the interesting thing is we then compared both of those cables to an older AudioQuest Ethernet cable, and it was clearly worse than the new cable. And we didn't really compare it so much to the stock Ethernet cable, but that cable actually was more expensive than the new cable. Huh. So AudioQuest was showing me that their technology, in theory, has improved and come down in cost. The old cable, I believe, was $69. The new cable we were listening to was
$29.
Now,
I'm sorry, go right ahead.
Again, we were talking about being at a hi-fi show, sitting in a room, listening to unfamiliar music on an unfamiliar system, and doing a few fairly rapid A-B comparisons.
Right,
so
exactly.
So we'll admit, and before the spheres start flying, that this was not a scientific test, and it certainly doesn't prove beyond any reasonable doubt that there is a difference, and I'm not refuting the laws of science, nature, or, the gods of Ethernet.
Yeah, right. Web 6797 in the chat room says, AudioQuest set up the test, so how can you trust it? And this is a valid question, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd have to ask the question, what would they have done to jury-rig the test?
I have no idea.
Neither do I.
Yeah,
but curious minds do want to know. I mean, if someone's going to suggest that a manufacturer is inclined to misrepresent what it is they're doing, I think that same person needs to put forth a proposition that would make sense as to how they would go about that. I mean, I've seen a lot of this attitude within the world of audiophiles. That will immediately assume that manufacturers, recording engineers, musicians, are the last people in the world you can trust, and will do everything they can to mislead consumers. And I am not one to have that opinion without any kind of significant or substantial evidence. If you've got some ideas as to how they may have fixed the test, I'm more than willing to entertain a reasonable idea.
Sure. Well, certainly the idea of cables and their effect on sound quality, both analog and digital, is not one we're going to settle today.
Yes, we are. And I'm going to stay here. I have plenty of beer in my refrigerator.
Oh, well, good. Then we'll be here all night long, and we will continue to discuss this subject until we collapse and pass out.
Yes. I even have a hammer on my desk so I can beat
good.
It. If it shows any sign of life near the end.
There it goes. All right. Excellent.
The hammer.
One other issue among many that you've covered on your site recently is the difference, if any, between losslessly compressed audio and uncompressed audio. You were talking specifically, mostly, I think, about FLAC, F-L-A-C, an acronym that that I don't remember what it stands for, versus WAVE.
Free lossless audio codec.
Oh, free lossless audio codec. Yes, because it's free. Right, exactly.
I may have gotten that wrong, but
I think you're right, actually. But in any event, it's a lossless compression codec that reduces the amount of data that needs to be transmitted by a factor of roughly two, I would guess, as compared to a WAVE file, which is uncompressed. What were your findings there? Is there really much of a difference between uncompressed, which should be, once it's decoded, bit for bit accurate with the original WAVE?
Yeah, well, the issue I think we need to, I would like to make sure we're clear on what it is we're talking about. There's no contention, at least from me, that FLAC is in fact a lossless compression, meaning if you convert a WAV file to a FLAC file and then convert it back to a WAV file, it will be bit identical.
Right.
So that is clear. It has been suggested that the playback of compressed formats is where there may be some issues introduced. And essentially, the standard argument goes the unpacking, if you will, unpacking of the compressed format during playback causes some extra processing to occur, which may, in fact, introduce timing-based errors or jitter.
Mm.
And, you know, that's one of the arguments. So I think it's the most popular. And really, I had come across a few people, and most recently, Todd Garfinkel of MA Recordings, suggesting that FLAC playback, was not the same as WAVE playback, which I found interesting. So, you know, I did some listening comparisons between FLAC, the same song actually, mm-hmm. a FLAC version and a WAVE version, over and over and over again throughout the day, quite literally throughout the day and into the evening.
Mm-hmm.
So the differences that I heard, which I did hear, are in fact subtle, and they do take some time and attention to hear.
Mm-hmm.
Now, some readers felt that kind of repetition and that kind of listening was odd, to say the least.
Well, I would think you might suffer from listening fatigue after a while, and your perception might change over a long period of time.
It very well could. One thing I would offer is that, first of all, I very much enjoy the track I listen to.
Well, that would help, Bonnie, certainly.
Yes, Bonnie Prince Billy from The Letting Go. But the other thing I would suggest is if we've ever seen musicians practice, or if we've ever seen someone trying to learn a new skill, a repetition clearly plays a part. So, you know, it's not such an unusual thing to do. And I've since spoken to a number of people, and the method of listening to the same track over and over tends to be, I think, effective in being able to determine difference. You know, mm-hmm. so much of one's job in terms of reviewing audio components is listening for difference. It's comparative listening.
Right.
And repetition is kind of the game. You know, you see very often reviewers talk about having test tracks or, you know, favorite tracks that they use repeatedly.
Sure.
And I think there's good reason for that.
Well, we do the same thing, certainly, in video testing, which I do more of than audio testing. But, you know, we have our favorite Blu-ray scenes that we use. And yeah. We see them over and over again, so we know them very well. So I'm sure the same thing is true of audio testing as well.
Yes, absolutely. And I think one sort of the tail end of this argument or discussion, from my point of view, is that I'm certainly not suggesting that I am in search of a best, an objective best.
Mm-hmm.
For me, this hobby of hi-fi is about enjoying and listening to music and having
yes.
that be an engaging experience.
Yes, and I've run across audiophiles who spend all their time, it seems, obsessing over, you know, drivers and measurements and stuff and such, and they're not actually listening to music, it seems to me. And I'm kind of going, well, isn't that the point?
Yeah, well, yeah, it's almost a cliche, but I guess there are reasons why things become cliche. But yeah, I mean, I've certainly encountered, you know, I've visited someone once and to hear their hi-fi. And he played me a few tracks from a few of his favorite records at that moment. I went back a few years later. He had changed his system. And he said, oh, I'll play some of my, you know, some of the tracks that I've been listening to lately. And I, without exaggerating, the 5 out of 6 were the same tracks I had heard years ago. And I find that to be a little problematic, you know. I mean, to me, the essence of the enjoyment of listening to music on the hi-fi is discovery. And
yes.
if your hi-fi doesn't have you wanting to run out to the record store or to download sites, or to then there's something wrong with your hi-fi. You know, if you find yourself listening to the same music over and over and over again, you've bought a machine that doesn't have a heck of a lot to do with the enjoyment of music.
Exactly right. And I would say that computer audio and streaming and so on gives you more opportunity to discover new music by far than going to a record store as we used to do.
The unprecedented access to almost a limitless amount of music. Quite literally, you can search for any piece of music you can think of and you'll find it online.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, it is clearly a revolutionary phase that we're in terms of access to music. It's mind-boggling, really.
Yeah. Well, I've got a couple of really great questions in the chat room, but before I get to those, I want to take a moment to thank one of the sponsors for this episode of Home Theater Geeks, which is Ford, featuring Sync with My Ford Touch. This Sync is in-car communications, entertainment, and connectivity that's voice-activated and lets you keep your hands on the wheel and your eyes on the road. Always a good idea, if you ask me. Sync services give you turn-by-turn directions, a great nav system, displays directional arrows on screen, all without having to purchase an aftermarket or integrated nav system. These services also include business search. You can search for over 40 million businesses, including telephone numbers, business information, and directions to the store. And a Send to Sync feature enables you to use Google Maps or MapQuest from your home or office to plan a trip. And you can save time online. You can save it, rather, I should say, online to your Sync traffic directions and information systems account. Then use voice commands in your vehicle to get turn-by-turn directions. a free Sync Destinations app is available in the app stores. It gives you mobile access to manage your Sync traffic directions and information system account on the go. The ability to pre-save destinations in your account, such as home or office, And you can get traffic updates sent to your mobile phone via text message. It's all designed to help you keep your hands on the wheel and your eyes on the road. Ford Sync with My Ford Touch is available in the 2012 Ford Focus. You can learn more about it and this and other technologies Ford is bringing to their vehicles at Ford.com/technologies. So, Michael, one of the questions that I had in mind to ask you, and F-Loop in the chat room has asked it, has beaten me to the punch here, as it were, which is the whole idea of external DACs, digital to analog converters, which seem to be a very large part of the computer audio universe, if you will. What's so important about them? You could have them inside the computer or outside the computer externally. Mm-hmm. Is there much difference between brands? I know that's a large area to cover, but give us your overview of that, if you would.
Well, let me start by saying I surely hope so, because I spend an awful lot of my time listening to different DACs.
let me start by saying, is there really a big difference between one DAC and the next?
Well, certainly. I mean, there are differences even in their approach to the technology. It's almost such a, I almost don't know quite where to start. I mean, it's always an interesting, we'll keep hitting on these hot buttons, but you can buy a USB DAC that simply connects to your computer's USB port. Pretty soon we'll be seeing them below $50. Mm. And you can buy a USB DAC for $15,000. Mm. Essentially two devices that do, is the same thing.
Right.
So if in fact there's no difference between them, then we've got a problem, I think, to talk about. Yeah. But yeah, so certainly there's different approaches with the technology. One of the more recent and more popular approaches to the USB connectivity in terms of a DAC is asynchronous USB connectivity.
Exactly. In fact, Bruce S. in the chat room is saying, when he was referring back to our discussion of unpacking and timing issues, and saying, wouldn't an asynchronous USB DAC solve timing issues?
Well, the asynchronous USB DAC comes after any effect that the playback of an uncompressed file might have.
Or losslessly compressed, you mean?
Yes, losslessly compressed. Yeah, FLAC playback. Right. So, the idea that is, it's an interesting point. But the time, I'm hesitant to jump right on that without giving it some thought, which is
okay.
Always,
Well, that's fine. That's a very good point.
In theory, and certainly in some practical implementations, asynchronous USB DACs have offered very low measured jitter performance. Mm-hmm. If you look at Art Dudley reviewed the wavelength cosecant DAC, and John Atkinson provided measurements, and I believe in the measurements section in the comments, he said something along the lines of this, it offered the lowest measured performance of certainly any USB DAC he had encountered or measured. So one would be under the impression that if there were any issues with timing errors, the DAC would in fact not be passing them along. So right. You know what? I think the end is that was a very good question, and I don't think I have a good answer at this point.
Well, I think you'll have to, maybe you'll post something later on this after you give it some thought.
Certainly.
And so I would suggest that people who are interested in that particular topic, which I happen to be, check in with audiostream.com a little bit later, and hopefully we'll see some more considered thoughts on the subject than can be done on a live show.
Yeah, I was kind of expecting that to occur. You know, that was one of the things that, boy, what happens if I get asked a question I don't know?
Right.
And I think, yeah, my wife said, well, why don't you just say you're not sure? I said, no, you know what? That's a pretty good way to approach it.
You know, that's the way I approach it, too. When I am asked questions about home theater stuff that I don't know, I say, well, I'll have to do some research on that and get back to you.
Yeah.
So is USB the best connection for a DAC? It may be the only one available these days. I'm thinking of FireWire, perhaps, or...
Yes, there are a few DACs that offer FireWire connectivity. And also, we shouldn't overlook Toslink. MacBook Pros come with, it's something that's easily overlooked, the headphone out, which most people look at as a headphone out, actually incorporates a Toslink connection. So
which is optical digital audio.
Optical digital audio, just mini Toslink to plug in to that port. And yeah, you're good to go Toslink out. So I will, in the very near future, be comparing, because I have a few DACs in that offer both USB and Toslink inputs, some comparisons between the two. But I would not say that one can draw any conclusions that one connectivity method is simply better than another. It absolutely comes down to the implementation in the specific DAC.
Right. You know? Right. How important is the... Well, one question that actually somebody asked you, one of the things I like about your website is that you answer reader questions, as I do on home theater. And I think that's a great thing to do. And one of the most recent reader questions I saw on there was, what happens when your audio file specs, the resolution, the bit depth, and the sample rate do not match those of the DAC? And I'd love to hear your response to that.
Yeah, could you just to clarify what we're talking about, or could you give me an example? I'm not
well. Your DAC maybe is 24 bit, 192 kilohertz.
Yes,
but your audio file may be 20 bits at 88.2 kilohertz. For example, what happens?
Well, the answer to that is it depends. And it depends on a few things, but I guess the easiest place to start would be what you've told your media player of choice to do. So in other words, you have, and it does depend from media player to media player. And also, you know, and that includes iTunes, which is a media player as well. So the easiest example, and if we want to start with, I think, one of the more popular players, iTunes does not offer sample rate conversion.
Because that's really what we're talking about here.
I'm sorry?
That's really what we're talking about here, is sample rate conversion.
Yeah, exactly. So if you're using iTunes, you set the bit sample rate in iTunes setup. And no matter what you play through, iTunes will up or down sample to that specified rate. Typically, that rate is set to match your DAC.
Mm-hmm.
How, you know, and that is, in my opinion, one of the largest strikes against using iTunes as a player for anyone interested in high-resolution downloads.
Ah, interesting.
Well, sure, you know, if you've got a mixed library of ripped CDs at 1644, and now you're starting to go to sites like iTracks or HDTracks, and buy high-resolution downloads, if you're playing all those through iTunes, it's going to pipe and tunnel everything through down or up to the same bit sample rate. That's why the market for add-on players or replacement players for iTunes is so important. Again, products like Amara, Pure Music, BitPerfect, those are all on the Mac side. FUBAR 2000 is a free PC-based player. J River Media Center. There are a lot of them. I don't, you know, there's more than I could list right now.
Sure, and those are all software programs that replace iTunes playback.
They either replace it or they ride on top of it. Pure Music plays along with it. BitPerfect plays very much in the background. You don't even know it's on, essentially. And so one of the nice features they offer is automatic sample rate conversion. Another extremely important feature they most offer is exclusive access, which also can be called hog mode, that essentially will override for Apple computers core audio getting involved in processing of music.
Right.
So it's a cleaner path from your music out to your DAC. That's a very simplistic way of putting it. But
sure. You know. Oh, that's fine. But doesn't iTunes do sample rate conversion in that if you have files at different rates, it'll convert them all to the one resolution that you have set?
That's what I'm saying, but that's not the ideal. The ideal is to play back in the native resolution.
Okay. Then what happens if you play back in the native resolution? Will most DACs, good DACs anyway, accept a variety of resolutions?
Yeah. Yes.
Ah, okay. Yeah, that's what I was trying to get to.
Yeah, another recent post, and that actually seemed to be very popular, was simply a listing of 24 192 capable USB DACs. So if you are interested in high-resolution downloads, specifically 24 172 files, let's say, from HD tracks, you need to have a DAC that can play them back at their native resolution, or you're not going to enjoy the full benefits of the higher resolution.
Sure. what about DSD? This was the other question I had, and another article you had on your site that I thought was very good. DSD is the format that digital audio is encoded in on SACD discs, which never really got all that popular, except among audiophiles. Audiophiles did seem to adopt it as a physical medium that they liked, and now it's possible, I think, to get DSD files onto your computer, but you need a special DAC to decode them, to take them back into analog, right?
Yes, absolutely. A DSD-capable DAC, as well as a media player that can handle the DSD format. Some convert DSD to PCM. That's another argument, you know. I'll need to get the hammer again.
Yeah,
it's hard to hit software-based arguments with, but yes, essentially you would need the hardware to handle it. But I think the more interesting question is, where does one source DSD files to begin with? Ripping an SACD is possible, but it's geek-only territory.
Mm.
You know, there are very few. I wrote about it in that post, and I provided some links to the means of ripping SACDs, and it's not for the casual listener. So there are a few online sites that are offering DSD downloads, but the selection at present is limited, to say the least.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the appeal here is more of a, in my opinion, is at this point, it's a theoretical appeal with a lot of promise. Whether or not we're going to see that promise delivered on in terms of access to tons of DSD music remains to be seen.
Do you find DSD encoded files to sound better generally than PCM, which is the other primary way of encoding digital audio?
Yeah, well, the only opportunity I've had so far to listen to DSD files natively was at, again, the show at Rocky Mountain. It was only through headphones in a very noisy lobby.
Not the ideal environment.
That wouldn't really be a fair comparison. I hope to get in one of the DSD-ready DACs and explore this. I think people were most excited about the MyTech DAC at Rocky Mountain. It was retails, I believe, for $1,600, which is a very interesting proposition, because prior to that product's release, I believe the next DSD-ready player was something like $6,500 from Playback Designs. So, you know, we're seeing, you know, the prices come down. Again, the same is across the board, even with USB DACs. So we will see, I guess.
We shall see, indeed. Before we go on, I would like to take another moment to thank the other sponsor for this episode, Netflix. which lets you watch thousands of TV episodes and movies instantly, stream to your PC, Mac, iPhone, iPad, or TV instantly. They're all streamed to you directly without saving you time, money, and hassle. Don't have to take back any discs, that's for sure. There are several ways to access Netflix, of course. You know that you can do it from your PC or your Mac. They now have apps for iPhones and some Android phones, the iPad. Most TVs offer it directly, as do most Blu-ray players, not to mention game consoles. PS3 and Wii and Xbox 360 all offer access to Netflix directly. You can even start watching on one device and finish the same program on a different device. It's quite remarkable, actually. And again, it offers you access to thousands of TV shows and movies instantly, saving you time, money, and hassle. And you can cancel any time, although why would you? For TWIT listeners, Netflix is offering a free 30-day trial, which you can access by going to netflix.com/twit. So, Michael, I wanted to ask you in the waning minutes of our show here. Generally, two things, really. Generally speaking, what are your favorite sources for high-res audio downloads?
Well, the options are still somewhat limited, and I guess... Boy, you know, if I were being politically correct, I'd say all of them are my favorites.
Yeah, but come on. It's just
HD Tracks has more of the kind of music that I am more interested in hearing.
Okay, and so in a sense, part of it is what your personal taste is.
Absolutely, yeah. And for me, if I can put it this way, if we're going to create a criteria, music quality comes first, sound quality comes second.
Very good.
Things fall down. So I'm much more interested in a crappy sounding copy of music that I enjoy than a great sounding copy of music that puts me to sleep.
Right. Aaron B. in the chat room says B&W has a great resource. It's true. They have their Society of Sound, which offers, I think, high-res downloads, right?
Yes, absolutely. And it's all, I would want to use the term curated, but it's put together by, and I'm not going to remember, so I'm not going to try and guess, but it's someone like Peter Gabriel.
I think it is Peter Gabriel, as a matter of fact. Yeah, I'm pretty sure that's correct.
Yeah.
One of the ones that I like very much, and its founder has been on the show a couple of times, Mark Waldrop, is iTracks. Have you had much experience with that?
Yeah, you know, I don't yet. I'm certainly well aware of it. Mark was kind enough to participate in one of the earlier articles on the site, the future of high-end, future of computer audio. So we had an email exchange, and I certainly intend to explore his catalog in the very near future.
Mm-hmm. Let's see. I got a question here. Oh, Hermes in the chat room wanted to know about your David Lynch album review.
Well, what's not to like about a record from David Lynch? I can hardly be critical in any way, shape, or form. You know, he's a fascinating character. He's incorporated music into his films in a way, I think, unlike many and most other directors, in that it's not a soundtrack. The music at times plays a very important role in his films. And he sings and plays guitar on this album, and he's written the songs.
Wow. And
so, yeah, everyone should have a copy of Crazy Clown. I don't even remember the name. It's great, though. I mean, I enjoy David Lynch. I enjoy his movies, and he's a fascinating character.
Is he a good musician?
You know, I think good is one of those words that I can use, but it's not going to... You know, I could easily see a lot of other people saying it's bad. I might even agree that it's bad, but for me, that might be good.
Dr. Mack
is Segovia.
He's not Segovia. Okay, no, I believe that. Dr. Mack in the chat room asks, "What do you use to digitize LPs and cassettes?"
Boy, you know, cassettes. I won't be able to answer that question off the top of my head. For LPs, there are a variety of options, and those options do depend on how much one wants to spend and the resulting quality of the rip. So you've got anything from USB turntables with USB ports on them. There's a ton of them out there. They're very inexpensive. There are now
because they're very inexpensive, I would think they aren't very good.
Yeah. I've not tested any of them. I've not had any in for review, but I think that's a fair assumption to make. And I would say the next step up is there are some DACs that offer with incorporated phono stages. So it's USB in, phono stage out. And there's some from PureTech offers one. I believe NAD has one, and there are others as well. Just not going to recall. And then, you know, there are software-based solutions, Pure Vinyl being the most popular one. Michael Fremer reviewed it very favorably. That's from Channel D, the makers of Pure Music. That also involves some hardware requirements as well, A to D converters. I got to see a demo of that process in Denver, Rocky Mountain. It's fascinating. So again, that's Pure Vinyl is the name of that product. Mm-hmm. You know, it's time consuming. You have to be ready to devote some real time.
If you want to do it right and well, yeah.
If you want to do it right, yeah. Manually tagging each track, you know, it's not obviously, I've not seen any software capable of reading track and album information off vinyl.
I think not.
It's viable, it's out there, and there's lots of options. Just depends on what your end game goal is.
Yeah, your budget, both yes. In terms of money and time.
Yeah, absolutely.
We have 3341 in the chat room asks, has been patiently asking, is HD Tracks native high resolution? It is, isn't it?
Well, that's, you know, it depends on what we're talking about. Well, first of all, HD Tracks offers 1644 downloads. So not everything that you can buy from HD Tracks is in fact a high resolution download, but it's very clearly stated on the site. There has been some controversy over the sales of music that has originated, prior to any digital recording, certainly, that's been upsampled to a higher resolution. Some people don't believe, I don't want to speak for Market iTracks, but I believe that for Market iTracks, he feels that anything that's called high resolution should in fact have been recorded natively in a high resolution format.
Exactly.
You see, we've got some, but so you can download Ella Fitzgerald and Louis Armstrong from HD Tracks 2496 or 24172, and certainly those recordings weren't done in a digital high resolution format originally.
Right.
but nonetheless, I mean, what we're talking about is, you know, whether or not the end result, the file sounds, does it sound better than the CD? Does it sound better than a ripped CD? And I'd have to say, in the few instances that I'm aware of, the answer to that question is yes, they do.
One more question from Web 3341. Does upsampling improve or degrade the sound? Probably, once again, it depends.
Yeah, that's, you know what, I should have just written that on a card. It certainly does. Yeah, it depends on any number of things. The quality of the original recording, the process used to upsample, one's own personal preferences. I mean, many of the media players that I mentioned earlier offer the ability to upsample everything, you know, to a specific bit sample rate. And some people prefer that sound, while others prefer to listen to files in their native format. I think it's clearly a question of personal preference. Mm-hmm. Again, and since it's so easily accomplished in software, listening to things in their native resolution versus upsampling, it's not really, I don't believe, anything that needs to be pained over. You just simply listen and decide for yourself which you prefer.
Well, listen, I wish we could go on. There's a lot more that I have on my list to ask you, but that just means you'll have to come back again, will you?
I will have to come back, yes.
Excellent. Absolutely. Thank you so much, Michael, for being on the show.
Well, thank you, Scott, for having me. It was a pleasure.
Thank you. I'm glad you had a good time. You can read all of Michael's content, all the things he writes about, which are all the things we talked about, and then quite a bit more, at audiostream.com, which is a new sibling site of the company that I work for that produces my site, hometheater.com. You can also email me at scott@twit.tv, and you can follow me on Twitter at htgeekscott. Next week, my guest geek is scheduled to be Kevin Vakes, the speaker designer for Revel Speakers and the head of product development for the Harman High Performance Audio Group. And we're going to be talking about all things speakers. Should be very interesting. So I sure hope you'll join me for that. Until then, geek out.